Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, filling in for Ann today. One of the most controversial and hotly debated issues in the U.S. in recent years has been the Affordable Care Act. The history of healthcare policy debates is filled with familiar concerns about costs and government intrusion, patients' need, and government responsibility. Joining us now by the phone to discuss what we can learn about current healthcare debates by looking to the past is Jessica Older. She's a visiting researcher at Tufts University and the author of the recent article, People Were Skeptical About Veterans Hospitals Too, the Affordable Care Act and Health Policy Precedents. It's being published in Origins Magazine. For a link to her article, you can go to our website, wosu.org/allsides. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So your article compares the creation of health services for veterans after World War I and the Affordable Care Act. So let's set the scene for this. At the beginning of the 20th century, when did the health care of veterans become such a concern?
Well, providing medical services for former soldiers had always been a concern, and veterans have always enjoyed a special relationship with the federal government. But what happens in the lead up to World War I is that there's a sort of rethinking of how medical services should be provided. What we see is Woodrow Wilson calling on some of his progressive reformer friends to come in and try to shape legislation that's going to ensure that soldiers of the recent war are provided for. And these people have great faith in the abilities of government and the abilities of professional medicine to really provide a better life for people. And so they basically look to what came into existence after the Civil War with some horror. At the moment of World War I, we see, as I mentioned in the Origins article, more than 35% of Northern veterans of the Civil War are being covered by federal pensions. And this is a huge chunk of the federal budget.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of things in terms of Civil War veterans is that 17,000 Civil War veterans are being housed in what are called soldiers' homes, 10 national soldiers' homes across the country. And then there are also state soldiers' homes. And these are different than hospitals. These are places that offer what's called domicile care. So the focus is not really on medical cure, but it's much more on basically giving old men who don't have anyone else to turn to.
They're like nursing homes for soldiers, essentially.
Exactly. And this is not by virtue of any failure on the part of Civil War era planners, but simply because ideals surrounding care had changed by the World War I era. By this time, throughout the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, we see a huge transition in kind of ideals surrounding how people want to get medical care. We go from having the ideal situation be accessing care in the home to hospitals having clear advantages. Technologies like the X-ray had been created, and of course there had been a huge socioeconomic shifts in society in general, where people are living in cities, they're living in crowded apartments, and so getting care in hospitals makes more sense.
Mm-hmm.
So bringing it back to World War I and your question, these progressive reformers who are sort of shaping this legislation and who are going to influence army policies surrounding rehabilitation really look to the hope of having soldiers rehabilitated in what were really pretty new, very large army hospitals. And the idea was, let's rehabilitate these people before they re-enter society as veterans.
So what were some of the biggest concerns about these hospitals?
So in the beginning, in terms of the biggest concern was to alleviate the need for the creation of anything like the Veterans Bureau or Veterans Hospitals. I mean, the main goal of these progressive reformers was to make sure that there was no long-term obligation on the part of the federal government towards these people. So in order to do that, the people who shape what's called the War Risk Insurance Act, which is the major piece of legislation passed before around the time that the United States really becomes involved in World War I, the main goal is to say, Let's take care of these people before they become civilians so that we don't have something like the Civil War system where we have the creation of more institutions and we have a lot of dependency among a veteran population. And there's a great book about this by Beth Linker, and she talks about this kind of shift to a rehabilitation mindset in the Army itself. So the prime concern, to answer your question, was to make sure that there wasn't this huge expense after the war. And I can talk to you about how these policymakers tried to make that happen if you...
Well, you said the phrase progressive reformers a few times now. Was the opposition mostly along party lines? Was it progressives versus conservatives in terms of offering this federal government health care?
Well, at this point, we don't see opposition. What we see is a lot of discussion among progressive reformers. These are basically people who are volunteering their services with the government to help advise on what policies should look like, lawyers, social workers. And these people are very much of this time period, 1910 to 1920, where you see this huge burst in regulatory legislation that's really intended to protect citizens from like the ravages of business, the ravages of society. For example, I'm talking about legislation like the Meat Inspection Act. Basically, lots of examples in this time of people like those who come to shape this pre-war legislation really using the government for one of the first times in history as a means of protecting citizens from possible dangers. So in terms of discussions that are going on and debates, the main question at this point is not, well, should we provide medical care for soldiers? Everyone really, really supports the idea of avoiding long-term dependency, making sure that people are taken care of, but people do have different approaches and perspectives on how to do that. So you have some people, medical doctors from the civilian hospital world saying, well, let's use civilian hospitals and let's make sure that people are taken care of among other citizens. And then you have others arguing, well, no, these people need to be retained within the military and treated in military hospitals. So basically so that they do not leave and do not shorten the process of rehabilitation before they are fully, as the term that the Army policies use is maximum curative results. So before somebody has these maximum curative results, the main issue is let's avoid these people going back into the world before before they can be productive workers, before they can be fathers and sons in a contributory, productive sense.
We're talking about parallels between the Veterans Health Administration and the Affordable Care Act. We're joined by Jessica Alder, the author of the new article, People Were Skeptical About Veterans Hospitals Too, the Affordable Care Act and Health Policy Precedents. Listeners, join the conversation. Call 614-292-8513. Again, that phone number, 614-292-8513. You can also email allsides at WOSU.org. You can tweet the show at WOSU All Sides and send us a note on Facebook. One argument that echoes in both cases is the Affordable Care Act and the Veterans Health Administration is the issue of federal government having too much power. The VHA was in the 1920s before the New Deal. So it was before a lot of concerns about a bloated federal government. Is that fair to say?
That's part of the point is that, yeah, this formation of this veterans health system is really kind of groundbreaking in terms of what it's saying the capabilities are for the federal government. So basically what we see is, you know, picking it up from before the war, we see policymakers provide for this system where the Army service members from other branches are going to, in some cases, be treated in Army hospitals. And we see basically the creation of a huge military rehabilitation program that consists of everything from orthopedic surgery to vocational and occupational education. And what we see is that for so many different reasons, the problem is overwhelming for a military medical system. Just two examples. For example, there is a lot of confusion about when a soldier should be discharged from the Army. So we have doctor saying, well, this patient has reached what's called maximum curative results. And on the other hand, we had patients thinking, I am not fully cured. I should be retained in this hospital until I can really feel like I can support myself and provide for myself. Another example, we see soldiers complaining about being subject to army discipline while they're being treated in these hospitals, being kept in special wards because of disciplinary infractions, like leaving a hospital grounds without permission. And all of these sort of soldier complaints point to the fact that the military health system is just not really ideologically or physically suited to taking care of what's really going to be a very protracted long-term problem. You know, how do you treat a disabled soldier? Do you treat that soldier as, a venerated citizen that had done his bit, or because he's still enlisted, do you treat him as someone who should be subject to discipline? So what we see eventually is the realization that this that the rehabilitation of soldiers has to extend beyond these military hospitals. And so we see the creation of this kind of hodgepodge system where a variety of previously existing federal entities are coming together to provide care for soldiers and recently discharged soldiers. And that system fails as well for a variety of reasons that I can get into. But I don't know if you want me to stop there and we can.
Oh, that's okay. We're talking with Jessica Alder. She's the author of the new article, People Were Skeptical About Veterans Hospitals Too, the Affordable Care Act and Health Policy Precedents. The Affordable Care Act, of course, had a pretty troubled rollout with its website. There were not websites back then when the VHA went live. Well, what were some other major problems with its inception, with its beginning, if there were any?
Yeah, well, I want to get back to the question you asked me before, which I never got around to. You asked me when this opposition to big government finally arose. And that sentiment in terms of the veterans health system really doesn't come about until the proposal is out there to provide hospital care for not just veterans who had service-related disabilities, but for all veterans. And so going back, you know, there's the creation of this system where, you know, a variety of pre-existing federal entities are going to provide care for veterans. That fails because the problems are so complex in terms of organizing this nationwide system for soldiers who had so many different complicated ailments. And then we see finally the support building for the creation of what's called the Veterans Bureau, and an affiliated system of hospitals. And at first, legislators are skeptical of the idea of the creation of this huge agency and these affiliated hospitals. And they basically are arguing that only people whose injuries and illnesses can be connected directly to service should have access to these institutions.
Directly to service, you mean wartime?
Right, exactly. So basically, they're making the argument that if somebody has a gunshot wound from the battlefields of France, of course that person should have access to federally sponsored hospital care. But what legislators have a lot more trouble accepting is the idea of somebody who comes into the Army with a pre-existing condition like mental illness, which many soldiers did. And legislators started to say around 1921, when the Veterans Bureau is created, well, we should take care of the people who have service-connected disabilities, but as for these people with previously existing conditions, well, basically, it's not our fault that this happened. And why should they have access to these institutions when somebody else who didn't go to war because, for example, it was the support system for a wife and child, which could earn somebody a deferment during World War I, why should he not have access to the same privilege? Mm-hmm. And you see even more and eventually the Veterans Bureau and its hospitals are created, and the original legislation does provide for soldiers who both incurred their disability and illness in the line of duty and had service-connected disabilities, but also for those whose injuries or illnesses have been aggravated. But in 1924, this opposition gains new steam when there's a proposal for all veterans, for all 4 million plus veterans of World War I to have access to these hospitals. And at that point, people, some legislators from both sides of the aisle really voiced a concern about socialism. They voiced a concern about, the issues that I talk about in that Origins article about the idea of, obliterating the notion of local responsibility, and some of the same concerns that really, these concerns really foreshadow what we saw around debates regarding the ACA.
Yeah, and I really want to get into that in our next segment. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue the conversation about the Veterans Health Administration and its parallels to the Affordable Care Act. That's just ahead here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and we're also streaming at WOSU.org/allsides. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown, sitting in for Ann today. This hour, we're discussing the creation of the Veterans Health Administration in the context of the more recent debates about the Affordable Care Act. Still with us is Jessica Alder. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right. Visiting researcher at Tufts University. Excuse me?
It's Adler.
Okay. I'm sorry. I mistyped it.
No, it's happened all my life. I'm used to it.
Okay. Jessica Adler, a visiting researcher at Tufts University, also the author of the recent article, People Were Skeptical About Veterans Hospitals to the Affordable Care Act and Health Policy Precedents, that's published in the February issue of Origins magazine. You can find a link on our website, WOSU.org/allsides. So, Jessica, when the debate starts to fuel about the Affordable Care Act, it was too perfect for you? Was it just like, oh my goodness, this is exactly what happened with the VHA?
I teach a history of health policy class, and so that class really has me thinking in a bigger way about the progression of health policy over the 20th century, and Lord knows there are lots of people who study that exact problem. And so the article in Origins is really trying to make the point that the ACA is just kind of the most recent example of the federal government offering assistance in the realm of access to health services. And I think there's a good awareness of that fact, but also that fact can be easily overlooked in the vitriolic debates that have taken place. But what health policy scholars talk about is the fact that throughout the 20th century we've really seen like a consistent expansion of federal involvement in bolstering citizens' health. This is, referring to legislation providing not only for a veterans' health system, but of course Medicare, Medicaid, children's health insurance later on, the expansion of the American Indian Health Service. We have healthcare, government-sponsored for prisoners, of course. And the point the article is really trying to make is that each of these federal programs garners a lot of controversy. And in some ways, the debates surrounding them are similar at various points in time. But of course, especially when you're comparing the Veterans Health System and the ACA, there are very, very big and very, very important differences. Not least of all, the fact that the people who are covered by the Veterans Health Administration are people who have served in the military and served their country. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that difference actually highlights one of the main reasons why the ACA is so different than legislation in the past, and that's because it doesn't cover a supposedly cohesive population, and instead it's kind of a bunch of different groups that were never covered by legislation passed in the 20th century. And in that way, I think that helps to explain why it's so controversial.
You mentioned the controversy over pre-existing conditions, and that's obviously one tie with the Affordable Care Act and the establishment of the VHA. This idea that pre-existing conditions, or at least from a large segment of the involved parties, that pre-existing conditions should not be covered.
That's an interesting parallel. What you see in the era of the passage of the Veterans Bureau and its hospitals is, as I mentioned, this resistance to covering pre-existing conditions, and that's, again, because these conditions, if you can think of the federal government as the service member's employer, basically during World War One, basically the federal government is saying, well, if it didn't happen under our watch, why should we be liable to cover it? And some of this, some of the controversy that surrounds the expansion of veterans' hospital care in 1921 and 1924 that I mentioned earlier has to do with who was actually inducted into the military and the conditions that really posed the biggest problems. It's really important to mention that that controversy surrounding access to these hospitals really was about people who, as I mentioned, had mental illness or tuberculosis. And these are conditions that weren't really seen as the heroic wounds of battle,
right.
But instead were seen as really, in this period, signs of some weakness. And so there are different debates surrounding different people, depending on what their conditions were, and of course, someone's social background. There's an entirely separate debate around black soldiers. But just to give you an example of what happens during induction of soldiers, we have more than, you know, there's all different numbers in terms of how the draft actually works. But according to a pretty reliable government document called HDoc 481 that I really look at a lot in my research, more than 200,000 soldiers are actually inducted into the military by their local draft boards before World War One. But then when they're sent to Army training camps, they are found physically unfit to serve. And all of those 200,000 soldiers during the war, you see correspondence among different government agencies, and it's eventually decided that legally the government is actually responsible to care for those people. Hmm. And so you can see why legislators by 1924, they're not worried about providing care for people who have, for example, amputations. They're more worried about these other populations that might not have even gone through training. And so you can see why the problem was complex and controversial.
We're talking about parallels between the Veterans Health Administration and the Affordable Care Act with Jessica Adler. She's the author of the new article, People Were Skeptical About Veterans Hospitals Too, the Affordable Care Act and Health Policy Precedents. I want to get back to this idea that of the military covering injuries or illnesses that were not directly battlefield related. Was it a radical idea at that time when that was first proposed?
The proposal to cover injuries that have been aggravated?
Yeah, I suppose it was. Was it Frank Hines who told Congress that all former members of the military, regardless of their injuries or illnesses, if they were connected to service, should have access to the facilities? Was this a groundbreaking idea?
It wasn't a groundbreaking idea. At the end of the 19th century, you know, I mentioned at the very beginning of our conversation this idea that pensions had exploded for Civil War veterans. And part of the reason was because they became decoupled from the idea of disability throughout the 19th century. And so this idea of the federal government providing for a soldier, not necessarily by virtue of him having incurred a disability in service, had been, that precedent had been set. But the difference in the World War One era was that you weren't just giving a soldier a higher monthly payment. What you were doing was granting him this kind of lifelong right, ostensibly, to institutional access. And that's, if you think about it, a much more expensive and a much more lasting obligation. You know, by World War One, this idea of federal involvement in assisting in an institutional way is not entirely new. And what I mean by that is the federal government provides aid to people who need institutional care. We see in the 18th century the creation of something called the Marine Hospital System that helped to provide care for merchant marines who were seen basically as a population that was potentially very threatening to the general population because they often traveled abroad and could bring back diseases like any epidemic disease like yellow fever, smallpox. So these institutions were set up to house them upon return to make sure that they didn't pose a health threat. And then in the 19th century, this federal involvement in institutional care expands with people with mental illnesses, getting federal help, people with developmental disabilities, orphans. But in my eyes, what we see in the World War One era is a massive expansion in this role for the federal government, where we see an entire population of people, not only because they're going to be, you know, potentially overwhelming for their local or state systems, but also because they're seen as worthy and having done something that has earned them this right. Mm-hmm. And we see that pattern followed again in the passage of legislation like Social Security in 1935 and Medicare in 1965.
We're talking about similarities between the Veterans Health Administration and the Affordable Care Act. Listeners, give us a call, 614-292-8513. 292-8513. You can also send your emails to allsides@wosu.org. And we do have a veteran on the line, Omar, calling from Westerville. Good morning, Omar.
Hey, good morning. How you guys doing?
Doing great.
Good.
Great show. You know, I'm a veteran, and I was deployed to Iraq a couple of times. And my last time, 2008-2009, my vehicle hit an IED, and I had a broken collarbone and destroyed my shoulder. And in 2009, I had a surgery at the Dayton VA. They did a reconstruction surgery for shoulder reconstruction, and they did a wonderful job. VA is a wonderful place. They took care of me when I really needed them, and I really opposed the idea of opening it up completely to every serviceman or woman, because the VA is there to help out when soldiers get wounded in the battlefield. And as a veteran, right now, I don't need the VA anymore. I don't use the VA. I went back to my civilian job. I am doing great. And I wanted the VA to take care of soldiers who are unable to do that, who are unable to go back to their job, who are unable to go back to, providing for their own family. I want the VA to be there for only to take care of soldiers that truly, truly need. I don't really, I oppose the idea, open it up completely, number one. Number two, the VA is not a standalone. You know, the money comes from the taxpayers. So I don't want to put a lot of pressure and have the general public disliking the veteran because, VA is, assigned so much money. You know, I don't want to do that as well. I don't want to put pressure on the taxpayers. So we want to keep it only for the people that really, really need it. And as far as the Affordable Care Act, I think it's gonna do a lot of good for most of the people, but it's not really comparable to the VA, in my opinion, because the only opposition that I've seen to affordable care is political opposition. It's like I hear the term all the time, big government. That's, to me, is just doesn't mean anything, because big government is the Republican and Democrat together. So which one are you talking about when you use the term big government? I don't know. It makes absolutely no sense.
Omar, you bring up some very interesting points. Jessica Omar says that the VA is intended only for troops who have served and been injured in battle. That's at least, with all respect to Omar, that's historically incorrect, right, as we've been saying?
Well, you know, what we see with the Veterans Health Administration, of course, is a priority system, and the roots of that are laid within, you know, as early as the 1920s, where people with service-connected disabilities like Omar have first priority and first access. And then going down a list of people with different ailments, injuries, and illnesses, there are different degrees of access, different responsibility for shouldering certain amounts of payment. But I do think, you know, I want to just make it totally clear that the Origins article that I wrote is not intended at all to say that the VHA and the ACA are the same thing. That is not at all my intention. The article really is really trying to make the point that basically the ACA is just one example of this federal involvement in healthcare. And that by looking at how and why the Veterans Health Administration became a reality, we can really kind of understand how health policy formation works in the United States and some of the recurring debates and ideas that surround the passage of these big pieces of legislation. And so I completely take to heart what Omar is saying, and it is not my intention at all to say that these two laws are doing the same thing. It's mm-hmm. just that by looking at the two of them in concert, we can learn a lot about some of the ideals that shape our government and the laws that we pass.
Well, Omar, thanks for your call. I hope you're doing well. That does bring up an interesting part here. What were veterans' thoughts? I guess what was veteran input when a lot of the VHA was put into place? Was it mm-hmm. was it sought, or was it just kind of there naturally because obviously veterans had concerns and had a stake in the issue? But how was their input? How did it factor into the whole formation of the VHA?
Yeah, well, I mentioned that when veterans are being treated within military hospitals, they are individually voicing their concerns, and they're doing that in congressional testimony. They're doing that by filing complaints with the Army Inspector General. And then in 1919 and 1920, you see the creation of what remain very influential veterans advocacy groups like the American Legion and the Disabled American Veterans. And these groups really give voice to some of the problems that were very real for thousands of soldiers. And what happens is you had this support building among government administrators and bureaucrats, like the Surgeon General of the Public Health Service, the director of an agency called the Bureau of War Risk Insurance. So the people who are actually overseeing care for soldiers and veterans immediately after the war are saying this system is not working, and they are joined in their complaints and concerns by representatives of the American Legion, Disabled American Veterans, Veterans of Foreign Wars. And these groups help to, to help shape legislation and to really move debates away from the idea of just basically giving more money to public health service hospitals to treat veterans, and instead saying what we need is an entirely new agency, a new hospital system that's geared only towards people who have served in the military. And so these groups do a lot to shape the system. And one very important thing that they really stick to very determinedly is to ensure that veterans are going to have hospital care near their homes. And this is a very difficult thing to do, mainly because there are three types of veterans hospitals at the beginning in the early 1920s. Tuberculosis hospitals, hospitals to treat people with mental illness, and general medical and surgical hospitals. And so it was very easy for the government to say, okay, a soldier from Arkansas has to travel to Denver to go to the tuberculosis hospital because there's no tuberculosis hospital in Arkansas. But what these veterans advocates do is they say that's not good enough, and we want our constituents to be able to be treated near their homes and to receive proper treatment for whatever ailment they have. So this is what really leads to a huge expansion in the veterans hospital system in these years, because you have a variety of types of institutions that are necessary in a variety of localities, because these veterans groups voice the idea that the idea of settling is not acceptable.
Omar, a veteran himself, said that he did not think people who were not injured on the battlefield should be treated by the VA. Is that a unique position among veterans? I know you talked about how it was a big issue in the formation of the VHA, but that seems like almost I don't want to say counterintuitive, but it seems like against their self-interest.
Yeah, well, there are really interesting documents in on the record pertaining to this question. For example, in 1922, the Veterans Bureau sends out a circular to thousands of veterans. They put it in an envelope along with their with information about their insurance policies. And it says, it basically contains a list of all the things that the Veterans Bureau was doing for veterans, providing $1 million a day in insurance payments and, offering hospital care for people who needed it. And what you see in the files of the Veterans Bureau and the National Archives is that hundreds of these circulars were mailed back to the government with notations on them from veterans themselves that really contain a variety of perspectives. So one perspective is, this is great, keep up the good work. You know, people just writing on the bottom of the circular. But another group of these veteran responses is definitely, there is a lot of fraud going on. There are a lot of people getting this service that don't deserve it. Mm-hmm. And so there's definitely, you know, as Omar is saying, there are divides within the veteran community itself about who is worthy of this privilege. And that transfers over to government, to legislators, and this variety of opinions really shapes debates around the issue, just like it does today.
We're talking about similarities between the Veterans Health Administration and the Affordable Care Act. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll continue the conversation with Jessica Adler. She's a visiting researcher at Tufts University and the author of an article in Origins magazine comparing the implementation of the VHA and the Affordable Care Act. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming at WOSU.org. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Steve Brown sitting in for Ann today. In this hour, we're discussing the Veterans Health Administration and its similarities to the Affordable Care Act. A lot of similarities that have been pointed out by Jessica Adler. She's a visiting researcher at Tufts University. She's also the author of an article in Origins magazine called People Were Skeptical About Veterans Hospitals Too, the Affordable Care Act and Health Policy Precedents. She's brought up a lot of really interesting similarities. The one that really stuck out to me was the controversy over pre-existing conditions that existed with the Veterans Health Administration. There was some resistance to cover issues like tuberculosis and any other ailments that were not actually acquired on the battlefield. We're trying to reach Jessica now. It appears we have her back on the line. Jessica, are you with us?
I'm here.
And I'm sorry, I don't know what happened to the phones there. But I have Jessica Adler back with us here on the phone. So in the late 1970s, VA doctors pioneered an electronic health record system that continues to serve as a model for private sector institutions. What else do you see as outgrowths of things established by the Veterans Bureau, by Veterans Healthcare?
Well, the Veterans Hospital System is one of the first in the 1950s to officially desegregate in the United States. And that has to do with the fact that it's a lot easier in some ways to run a federal system if you don't have to think about separating people by not only by their social background, but also by their disease or ailment. And because it's federally sponsored, it is much easier to implement that kind of huge advancement within the veterans' health system than it is within the private sector.
Because it's smaller?
Just because it's federally run. So you don't mm-hmm. have, for example, one... you can basically say to a hospital administrator, you must do this.
Right, yeah, I gotcha.
And the hospital administrator, as an employee of the federal government, has to comply. I think that we see, trying to think of other, really what happens is we see the veterans health system become, more recently, the site of debates that echo those that took place in the 1920s. And we see people, we saw Mitt Romney in the presidential election bring up the idea of the privatization of services in the Veterans Health Administration, and that is roundly rejected and criticized by veterans advocates and others. And really, the Veterans Health System is unique even among the systems that I mentioned throughout our conversation, like Medicare and Medicaid. And that's because it's what they call an integrated system, which means that the government both pays for and provides services in many cases. And so this is like, if you are thinking about it in a larger sense, this is the most more closely resembles a socialistic health service system than any other. And so in that way, it's very unique and very different. So I don't know if
That's okay. That's okay. How would you characterize the health of the VHA today?
I think you see a lot of different perspectives. Whenever I tell people that I research and write about the veterans' health system, I get one of two responses. One is, wow, veterans are so lucky. They have access to this amazing system. Mm-hmm. And then the other response is, that is a completely backwards and terrible system, and it's such a shame, and look at that huge backlog of claims files that are not being dealt with. And so they're really polar perspectives on what this system is. But what you see is basically that some of the problems that took root in the 1920s continue to exist today. And you see in as early as 1923, 2 years after the Veterans Bureau becomes a reality, veterans are writing, complaining about the fact that they do not have access to institutions when they think that they should. They're complaining about the quality of treatment that they're getting. They're complaining about just general administrative difficulties and delays. And so really the beginning of this system is, it's the story about the beginning of this system is the story of how messy policymaking is. And you mentioned this idea of the rough rollout of the ACA. Well, when the Veterans Health System started, we had just really no clarity on very important issues. You see bureaucrats within the Veterans Bureau writing to each other saying, okay, this, a hospital director might write to the Veterans Bureau and say, okay, I just had a patient come to me with this problem. Are we supposed to admit this patient to our hospitals? And who is actually eligible for this care? And you see throughout the 20s and 30s, rules about disability ratings changing. You see the definition of service connection changing. And so really what we see with this story and what we might see again with the ACA is that a policy is passed, but that does not mean that the story is over. Once a policy becomes a reality or a law becomes real, it still has to be implemented and it still has to be administered in an efficient way, and sometimes that only happens once the law is on the books and the agencies are created, and people correspond with each other and figure out how the system should work.
Yeah, my best friend in life is he served two tours in Iraq, and he has had an absolutely nightmarish experience with the VA. And then a coworker here says she has had a wonderful experience with the VA. So, it does vary different. It apparently varies quite a lot depending on users. I do have an email here from Mary Jo. She says, I'm most surprised by some of the intense opposition to the ACA by church groups ranging from evangelicals to Catholic bishops, I guess, because she says they somehow see this as an abortion enabler. I'm not trying to comment on that. She does ask, though, what was the reaction to churches to the VA hospital establishment?
You know, I haven't looked into the issue of religious organizations and their feelings about this, the implementation of this health system. One thing that I will say, though, perhaps related, is that two things. First of all, veterans hospitals in their early years become in many ways part of a sort of loosely defined and not very cohesive welfare safety net in a way. And you see correspondence from, for example, religious organizations to soldiers' homes and veterans hospitals discussing one particular patient and basically trying to figure out how to care for this individual in the best way so that he is most likely to return to his family and workplace in the most, hasty manner. So you do see different groups working together in order to serve this population. And the other thing that I'll say is that people, like I mentioned, the Surgeon General of the Public Health Service, the gentleman named Rupert Blue, and Blue and some of his colleagues at the Public Health Service are very much supporters at this time of compulsory health insurance, which was a larger societal debate, the idea of what we would now call universal health insurance. And some of the people that really pushed for the veterans' health system to be more expansive were people who supported, in general, compulsory health insurance and preventive medical care. These issues were very much discussed among civilian doctors for the greater civilian system, and some of the people who support the veterans' health system are supporters of generally expanding access for the general population.
We've spent the last 55 minutes or so talking about the VA. If we can broaden the conversation at all to other health care programs, government health care programs, what else could we learn about the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, from these other government programs? Are there any other takeaways that people really need to consider as new and additional parts of the ACA are implemented?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one thing that I really find interesting about thinking about federal health programs in general is just focusing in on debates about dependency. Regardless of whether the general population or politicians are discussing veterans' health care, the Affordable Care Act, the idea of dependency really seems to motivate opinion. For example, people who support more federal intervention seem to be anti-dependency, right? The idea among people like Rupert Blue was, if we create these veterans' hospitals, people will be able to eventually take better care of themselves. So the goal for these people who supported government intervention was eventually self-reliance. And then we see people opposed to the expansion of these entitlements on the same grounds, that they're saying basically that these offering this sort of entitlement is the very definition of dependency, of creating dependency. And so I think that's a pattern that we see repeatedly around debates about health policies throughout the 20th century and even now around the ACA.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can answer this in a minute or so, but how big of a, in the context of the rollout of all these federal health care programs, how big were the problems with the ACA?
They got so much
publicity, but how big?
Right. I think we're still seeing problems unfold. But I do think I don't know how to quantify, but I do think that they are no. It seems to me that the Veterans Bureau in its early years seemed pretty dysfunctional in a lot of ways, in a similar respect to the ACA. So,
sure.
One might find hope if they are a supporter of the ACA, but we will have to see how it plays out.
Certainly a lot to learn either way. Jessica Adler, a visiting researcher at Tufts University, also the author of a new article called People Were Skeptical About Veterans Hospitals to the Affordable Care Act and Health Policy Precedents. Ms. Adler, thanks so much for your time.
All right, thanks for having me.
And you're listening to All Signs with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're also streaming online at wosu.org/allsides.